Tropical Smoothie Cafe welcomes you to Tropic Time. I'll be your concierge. Our beach bites, including made-to-order wraps and bowls, are full of tropic vibes. And our fresh-from-the-blender smoothies make you feel absolutely radiant. It's like a wellness retreat for your taste buds. You're on Tropic Time now at Tropical Smoothie Cafe. Got breakfast plans? At Tropical Smoothie Cafe, hitting your protein goals is a breeze. With our smoothies, bowls, wraps, and dias featuring up to 32 grams of protein.
Hey, everybody. David here with another one of my interview projects. This time, I'm interviewing the brothers Elbein, Asher and Saul, two writers and journalists who publish a newsletter website called Heat Death. What is Heat Death? Not sure, really, but we talk about it during the interview. I think it was Davey Mack who first shared an article from Heat Death during our Rings of Power coverage a while back, and Marilyn and I discussed it briefly on one of our bonus segments on the history and context of orcs and the dilemma of creating an irredeemable species. I think the Heat Death site is a really interesting project, and I've enjoyed a lot of what I've been reading over there. They not only publish their own articles, but they've been reaching out and publishing some other authors and some really interesting articles there. And I think a lot of them have a lot of natural crossover between the kinds of things that they're publishing and some of the shared interests we have here in the Lorehounds community, especially with Tolkien and Star Wars, both of which we talk about extensively in this interview. We talk about their article, Orc is Man to Orc, as well as their long-running series on Star Wars called Decline and Fall, which looks at the Star Wars story as a historian might. We also get into a little behind-the-scenes talk towards the end of the interview. So definitely check them out. Follow them to get updates and subscribe if that works for you. I hope to be talking with them more again in the future, so stay tuned. As always, check the show notes for links, and this time I've included links for all things Heat Death there. As well, rate and review if you've got something nice to say. We always enjoy reading your feedback. Discord and email contacts and links to all of our other affiliated podcasts are also in the show notes. Check the link tree. Here's my interview with Asher and Saul Elbein. Asher and Saul, welcome to the Lorehounds. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks so much for having us.
Good to be here.
Yeah, pretty excited to be talking to you guys. I first came across Heat Death when one of our subscribers, pretty active user on our Discord, posted a link to the Orc article when we were doing the previous season of Rings of Power coverage. And the article was perfect because we had a Lorecast bonus segment about orcs and the history, you know, Tolkien and what he dealt with and all that kind of stuff. And so it was like perfect timing. And ever since then, I had been meaning to want to catch up with you guys and like send out an invitation. And then there was a recent newsletter post that you guys sent out, and I caught Tansy Gardam's name on there. And I'm like, wait, I know that person too. And it just sort of like activated me to reach out and to get in touch. And I know both you guys have a lot going on. So I really appreciate you making time to be with us today.
Yeah, of course. We're, I think, always happy to chat with other people who are interested in these sort of intersections of pop culture and culture.
Exactly. And that is really who we are. And I just feel a lot of spiritual and intellectual kinship with what you guys have posted on your stuff. And I've been trying to catch up over the weekend, you know, reading a bunch more, especially the Decline and Fall series that you have on Star Wars, which is going to be one of our topics that we're going to be covering today. The other one I wanted to talk about, that Orc article a little bit and sort of the Tolkien of it. And then we'll like wrap it up with some behind the scenes, like goes on with Heat Death, what you guys are working on. But was thinking about it over the weekend, this idea, this premise that fiction as a mirror to the human condition. And I was reading through your Star Wars stuff and the political allegory of it, but the real worldness of it as well really, really brought that home to me again, that you know, this work that we create in these fictional worlds is this reflection or this mirror of what we as a species are up to.
Mm-hmm.
I would almost say it like this. I would say, and I think this borrows from one of the structuralists, but that if you take any facet of the crystal, every facet of the crystal reflects every aspect of the culture.
Right.
And so you can, you know, some are more interesting to look at inherently, some are more generative. But I think that's one of our core beliefs at Heat Death, is that if you drill into basically any thread, well, that mixes the metaphor. if you start pulling any thread, then you know, a whole lot will come with it.
Exactly. And when we were doing our Rings of Power coverage, and Marilyn Arpakila, who is our favorite Tolkien scholar and one of our co-hosts on Lorehounds, she and I did this orc bonus episode, and that article that I think was it yours, Asher?
Yeah,
that was Asher's piece. I realized recently it's probably the best headline I've ever written, but it is Asher's piece.
So Asher, I was just curious, are you a big Tolkien person? I'm both of you, but I'll start with you, Asher. Like, how did you end up at this topic? Like, talk to us a little bit about what generated this idea, because I think the name itself, Orc is Man to Orc, that is such an evocative title. It's so simple, but it packs so much in it.
Yeah, Shaul really, really cooked with that one. The funny thing for me about my relationship with Tolkien is that, you know, I read The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings when I was a kid, and then I sort of drifted away from them for a pretty long time. Obviously, you know, I love the movies, but it's just somewhere along the line, I started thinking about orcs and the sort of way that orcs are portrayed both in the films and kind of my sort of gauzy sort of memory of how they were portrayed in the books. And of course, that kind of like long shadow of sort of orcs that are presented as being in the Tolkien style, right? You know, these sort of chaotic, vicious, sort of like ontologically evil entities that mostly exist just to be stabbed by our heroic protagonists. And, you know, the various attempts by various creators to kind of try and flip that on its head by making them, oh, well, no, they're not always evil. Sometimes they're like cool bikers, or well, what if they're like more like spiritual Native Americans? And just like all the, you ended up with this sort of like group of peoples that are either they're evil or they are presented as being good in subversion of the idea of them being evil, which also leads to some really interesting sort of unquestioned assumptions. And this has just been something that's just been like in the back of my head for a while. And I don't remember quite what got me really thinking about it, but it might actually have been Rings of Power was coming out, and I had recently rewatched the Lord of the Rings films, which are of course a titanic achievement in terms of cinematic fantasy.
Sure.
And you know, there's people make all kinds of jokes about some of the scenes in those movies, right? Like, meat's back on the menu, boys. But like, oh, they have menus, like they have the concept of menus. But there's just something about the idea of like the orcs being soldiers and kind of like hanging out and getting into arguments with one another, which is sort of, it just pulled something in my brain. So I ended up going back and sort of rereading some of Tolkien's sort of like ancillary writing and rereading Lord of the Rings. And I just started kind of jotting down some ideas, and kind of before I knew it, the piece really took shape around that. And it sort of wasn't intended to be a sort of definitive dropping of thoughts, but the more that I dug into it, the more that I pulled on those threads, as Shaul said, the more I realized that there was really a lot there to sort of dig into.
So I wanted to ask you a quick question, but I wanted to clarify in terms of folks tracking the voices on the podcast, Shaul or Saul are interchangeable names here. So you might hear.
That's right. Yeah. So Shaul is the Hebrew version of Saul, which is what people in my family call me.
Great. Okay, perfect. So Asher just commented that the title was your idea. Is that accurate? Orc is
today? Yeah. So I have the rarefied position in journalism at The Hill of getting to write my own headlines, or at least suggest my own headlines. I mean, they don't always get picked up, but if they're good, sure, they get picked up, which is quite rare. My future career, this never happened. So in this particular case, I wrote the headline. Asher writes a lot of the headlines too. Right. And I mean, I think, like, obviously it's a riff on "Man is a wolf to man," which is a Russian saying.
Oh, I'm not familiar with that one.
Okay, so this sort of inverts that.
Okay,
and it's and actually, I want to say a little bit about where this idea came from. So there's one of my intellectual lodestars in this is a classic modern work of anthropology called "The Cannibal Metaphysics" by the Brazilian academic Eduardo Viveiro de Castro. And one of the things that he argues in that is that he argues for this perspective. He argues for this position called radical perspectivism, which is sort of every creature is human to itself. So he uses this analogy that to a vulture, rotting meat is bread. To a armadillo, a wet hole dug in the ground is a nice cozy house. Everything is human to itself. Human is almost a pronoun. So that was how we started thinking about orcs. Like, to an orc, orcness is normal. To an orc, of course you're a cannibal because there's no meat elsewhere in Mordor. To an orc, your lot in life is that the Dark Lord came back, you're his slave, you have no options, and you make the best that you can because you don't have any choices. Like, that's what it is to be an orc. To be an orc is human.
Right. And I think it perfectly synthesizes and encapsulates the whole conversation around having an irredeemable species. And Asher, if you want to talk a little bit about Tolkien's dilemma, how you're perceiving Tolkien's dilemma of this idea of, well, if Eru Iluvatar breathed life into something, then it's his creation. And therefore it is of benefit. It can benefit from all of the various and sundry things that God has given to their creation. But yet, except these one group of things over here, no, you can just go ahead and stab them all you want. Like, it's no big deal.
Yeah. The thing that's really interesting about orcs in Tolkien's Legendarium is, of course, they start out as essentially wicked fae or something very equivalent to it. You know, the sort of dangerous, kind of mischievous, malevolent, but not tremendously more so or unusually so in The Hobbit. You know, in The Hobbit, there are Elrond's elves who are basically friendly, but, you know, maybe a little flighty. And there are the forest elves, which are not unfriendly, but also kind of mischievous and dangerous. The dwarves are the dwarves. And then you have the goblins of the mountains. And the goblins of the mountains are certainly a threat, and they're certainly dangerous, but they're not really presented as being, I think, sort of in soul that different from the other entities, because Tolkien is writing essentially a children's fairy tale. As he starts working on Lord of the Rings, the construction of the orcs and the goblins becomes, I think, a lot more serious. It loses a lot of that kind of sense of kind of whimsy. And in addition, behind the scenes, obviously, Tolkien is working on his sort of like the backstories that were eventually collected in the Silmarillion. And as Tolkien is sort of building this world out, he runs into a problem that it seems like he never really is able to solve, which is, you know, the elves are sometimes wise and sometimes tremendously foolish, like incredibly destructive in their foolishness. The dwarves can be noble and steadfast, but also greedy and pigheaded. And yet the orcs are always the great enemy, right? They're presented as being the great enemy of the elves and the dwarves and eventually people. And we never really see them as anything other than that. And in that they are an eternal enemy, Tolkien starts getting really, I think, uncomfortable with this idea of where such an entity could have come from. And he toys with a couple of backstories. The one that, of course, the film presented as basically being canonical is that the orcs are sort of elves that were captured and captive bred under presumably incredibly hideous conditions by the devil and then pressed into service by the devil's henchman, Sauron.
And this goes into the idea that evil can't create.
Yes.
It can only bend and manipulate and transform.
But this runs into the problem of, if these things were not created evil, if they were created with the capacity for good that was presumably not bred out of them, presumably their state has not been wholly changed, then, you know, you're not raising the question of, is it permissible to kill an orc? I mean, I think if you're in World War II, it is permissible to shoot a Nazi. But you do run into the problem of, it seems like orcs have been positioned as being at constant war with the other peoples of Middle-earth basically forever, since they arrived on the scene. And that seems to be something that Tolkien never really could quite wrap his head around how he wanted to deal with it. There's the very end of Lord of the Rings presents the orcs as soon as Sauron falls as sort of wandering away witless, as if they're sort of golems animated by his will. But that does not square with really any of thing in the rest of Tolkien's writing. It seems like something that it was a problem that he identified, but could never figure out how he wanted to solve. And I don't think he ever really did solve it, because I think it's kind of unsolvable.
I want to put a little asterisk here really quick, and then I'll come to you, Saul, is that to check in terms of our approach to Tolkien here, I'm assuming that neither of you consider yourself Tolkien scholars. So we're coming to it from outside of the academic world of Tolkien, where there is a very intense group of amazing academics and researchers. And so we're kind of approaching this material externally. Would that be fair to say that we're...
Sir, we are not scholars. We are journalists.
Yes.
The journalists, yeah, right.
So, yes.
Sorry, Asher.
I would say that is certainly true. I did, before writing this, because I do have a little bit of an academic background, go and read up on some of the Tolkien scholarship, because I didn't want to fly off half-cocked. No one has ever said this before.
Right.
Of course, there's been quite a lot of really sharp writing on this, and that is some of what I'm basing my sort of assessments here on.
And having worked in and around the Tolkien scholars and the Tolkien world for a couple of seasons now of Rings of Power in a preview series, and I just wanted to make sure I caveat that for our listeners, because people get rather excited about things in this world. So it's as they do with Star Wars, right? And we're going to get into some
famously
of that,
so I'd say
a little bit. But anyway, Saul, you wanted to jump in on something.
Yes. Okay. So don't at me, bro. You know,
exactly.
I'm the furthest thing from a Tolkien scholar. But I mean, on my recent rewatch of Lord of the Rings, it struck me that just how totalizing the power of Sauron is in the heads of anything to which he turns his attention. And how much more so when he has possession of the ring, but even when he doesn't. So, I mean, the idea of the orcs wandering away as though they're automata doesn't make sense. But if you imagine that everybody that you've ever known has had that voice in your head forever, and then that goes away.
Mm.
I mean, the example of the Nazis actually isn't crazy. I mean, obviously nobody had Hitler's voice in their head exactly. But I think, you know, there's plenty of historical examples of what happens after a real truly totalitarian system falls apart. You know, the kids who grew up in the Soviet Union, where Stalin was the sort of godlike figure. I mean, and then you take that and actually make it literal. Stalin's in your head. Stalin sometimes looks out through your eyes. That's part of what it is to be an orc.
I think that's a really interesting hook to hang a future part of our conversation when we get into the Star Wars of it all, because I think you've touched on some really interesting things there as well. And we on the Lorehounds love nothing more than to mix our IP worlds, because again, it's the crystal facet, right? As we look at one reflection, we see others. But I think this is really interesting too. And I'm aware of some of Tolkien's, I can't cite them, but I'm peripherally aware that Tolkien's view of the human condition as informed by his time in the trenches. He could even see that some of his fellow soldiers were orcish in behavior. But then we just layer in all of this, and I'm just going to throw the proverbial pot of spaghetti at the wall here. We've got bioessentialism here and just the idea of essentialism as a whole, regardless of bioessentialism. And colonial language, where we're otherizing people and we're boxing them up into this. And Asher, as you were working on the article, go through some of your thoughts and some of the things that you were encountering here. You have this great conversation too about Holmberg's mistake, or you're pointing to Saul. Is that Saul's thing? Or
yeah, that was a contribution that Saul made, based largely on our sort of mutual reading of some of the history around the interactions with Plain Indians and sort of other groups like that. But Shoa, why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so another one of the intellectual lodestars of Heat Death is Charles Mann's 1491, and maybe even more so 1493.
Yes.
And 1491 opens with a sort of frame story of an anthropologist who goes to this tribe in the Amazon who is very, very primitive. I forget the specifics, but they barely have bows and arrows. They wear rags. They have no fixed home in the forest. And he really builds a cosmology out of this. And he says, essentially, you know, this is sort of humanity in the state of nature. And what he misses is what's going on around them. These people are at the fringes of the Peruvian rubber boom, which is one of the great extractive industry holocausts of human history, of the modern world. They have no fixed home because they were chased out of their fixed home. And if they go back there, they'll be conscripted into an unbelievably brutal extractive industry. And so to Charles Mann, that represents the great category error that Americans, that Westerners in general have when they're looking at American Indians, because they, you know, white people only penetrated the interior of the continent hundreds of years after smallpox had. They never observed Native American life in anything like a truly autochthonous state. And we can argue about what it even means to have, you know, a truly untouched state. Obviously, human culture has changed, but whatever that might have been, no white academic ever talked to anybody who saw Native American culture before the penetration of and fusion with the cultures that they represented. And if you take that category error and you really sit with it, then the past becomes a truly uncharted country. And similarly, the orcs become a truly alien people. We were talking about bioessentialism a second ago. I mean, let's take the trench example. Let's imagine that Tolkien's orcish compatriots who'd been in the trenches with him for, I don't know what a tour of duty was, but let's say 18 months. Let's even say 4 years. Let's say they'd been there for generations. Like, they're still biologically human, right? They're still just as biologically human as the people on the front lines, but they're going to look different because they're eating differently. They're sleeping differently. They're living differently. They're having very different experiences. Now that's generations. I mean, Middle Earth, Sauron's been gone for thousands of years, and he was present for thousands of years before that. What did that do to those peoples? Let's say they're genetically identical to elves. Let's say that you clone an orc and you get an elf. That still doesn't tell us anything about the peopleness of orcs.
Look, if you're still buying weed from some guy named Trevor in a parking lot, you're doing it wrong. Mood.com delivers legal THC products straight to your door. Gummies, vapes, flower, the good stuff. No sketchy DMs, no med card. Just add to cart, check out, and boom, it's at your doorstep. It's legal in all 50 states thanks to the Farm Bill, and Mood's products actually work. Seriously, this isn't gas station garbage. It's small batch, lab tested, real results. Go to mood.com, use code FIRST20 for 20% off, and never run dry again. That's mood.com. Go get lit, legally.
To go back quickly, too, in terms of the anthropological aspect of it, never mind the kinds of observer effects that you have by going and sitting with and talking with and studying and how people then adapt and change what the stories that you are being told or listening to.
I've done a little bit of cross-cultural journalism,
okay,
where I'm working in Spanish, but with somebody who speaks a very different dialect of Spanish than the very like upper middle class, you know, literary version that I know,
mm-hmm.
Or where I'm working with a fixer or translator. And I gotta say, it is not clear to me at all what I'm getting.
Right.
Like, it's not clear to me at all to what extent what I'm getting matches what was given to me in the original. I can pick up intimations of great literacy on the part of my interlocutor that I can't access.
Asher, I'm curious as to your thoughts on essentialism or bioessentialism in this, because I don't think, did Tolkien have a sense of that? Was he being reductive towards humanity, or was he being reductive with creating this race? We certainly see one way that the movie deals with, Jackson deals with it, is Saruman bioengineers a biological weapon, which is called an Uruk-hai, right? He grows them in a little thing. But prior to that, what are we doing with essentialism and bioessentialism, which will leak out, and we'll talk about modern culture in a second with that regards, but I'm curious as to what your thoughts are in this topic.
Yeah, one aspect about bioessentialism that Tolkien's approach to fiction makes this a little tricky is that Tolkien is very gentlemanly in what he is and is not willing to describe. And so the question of the Uruk-hai is actually a really interesting one, because Tolkien will say, ah, yes, Saruman crossed orcs and men. And he draws a really discreet veil over how that might have happened, in the same way that he draws, even in his writing about, about Morgoth's, you know, abduction of, potentially, that Morgoth, you know, abducted elves and sort of bred them into orcs. He doesn't get very much into whether to what degree that was a biological process or a sorceress process or some mixture of them. And so you end up with this thing where, you know, the elves are presented as being basically like people. You know, maybe they're a little wiser, but their stupidities and sort of arrogances are sort of proportionally greater as well. Again, the dwarves are, you know, you never really see dwarf wives, but you see enough sort of individual variation in dwarves to presume that they basically act like people. And Tolkien, what Tolkien does with the orcs is that he doesn't...
Can I put a pin in something really quick too?
Please.
In any of our fantasy literature, can we ever write anything that is not humanized? Star Trek, they're all just bipedal humans, right? How do we ever really depict an alien race?
I'm going to make a case for Adrian Tchaikovsky's Children of Time.
Okay.
Children of Time builds a pretty cohesive and believable science fiction fantasy world around a civilization of wolf spiders. It is an exception that proves the rule, though.
And I would say C.J. Cherith has a whole series called the Foreigner series, where there's a single translator on this crash-landed planet where there's these two, you know, human culture and this other, Atavi, I believe is what they're called. And she does, I think, a pretty credible job in terms of teasing apart language. But anyway, Asher, we interrupted you. Please pick back up.
Well, I was going to say that I think Tolkien is not really able to stop himself from writing some of the orcs as having personality just because, you know, there's that great scene, I believe it's either in the Two Towers or Return of the King, I can't remember quite which, but Sam overhears two orc grunts.
Very famous conversation between Shadrach and Gorbag.
Just bitching about how awful it is to be a soldier in the Dark Lord's army and how much better it'd be to go off and just like be a freebooter somewhere. But we don't really spend that much time with individual orcs. It's enough so that conversation is sort of notable by kind of how rare it is. It's very easy to get the sense that all orcs are a certain way. There's the only other scene that gives you a sense of sort of intra-orc personality and tension is that scene. I know this is in the Two Towers where there's sort of representatives of three different orc armies arguing about what is to be done with Merian and Pippin. And, you know, you've got sort of like Saruman's orcs arguing with the Mordor orcs. And there's an orc who's come from Moria who is just completely uninterested in the dickering and is mostly just there to like carry out some revenge for all of the like sword and sorcery hacking and slashing that happened in the previous book. And that dude ends up getting murked at the end of the argument because he tries to intervene. But it's those two scenes. And so it's very easy, I think, to read.
I'll add in a third really quick. Sorry.
Yeah.
In the television series in the last season of Rings of Power, we get a flash of an orc baby.
Yes. Yeah, I remember that. It's like an unusual...
Not even a wink and a nod, a giant spotlight in the face of, hey, orcs are not what you think.
No, it's a moment. What's so interesting to me about Rings of Power is Rings of Power really tries to have its cake and eat it too.
Yes.
What I think is really remarkable about what Tolkien does with the orcs is that because he never resolves the problem just sort of sits there festering in the work. And I think that that's actually to the work's credit. Because contrary to the way that I think many people digested Tolkien, especially in the sort of like long aftermath of his fiction, but even to some extent today, is people talk about Tolkien's work as being about the great battle of pure good versus pure evil. And in actual fact, I think that those books, Lord of the Rings, and you really see this, I think, in his sort of like ancillary writings about the Silmarillion or the sort of like wars between the dwarves and the sort of orcs, it's the idea not that there is a pure good and a pure evil. It's that there is a fundamental, one might call it original sin, a flaw in the sort of basis of creation that everybody is constantly having to deal with. And there is certainly great evil, but it is not grand. Sauron and Morgoth's sort of pretensions otherwise, their evil is not grand. It is petty, it's totalitarian, it's vicious. But they can't really make anything. They can't really reshape reality in any sort of meaningful way. They can just sort of like fuck things up for everybody. And even when they're not doing that, you know, the theoretically great and wise elves and the theoretically like proud and strong dwarves are constantly causing problems for themselves through their own arrogance and pettiness and small-mindedness. And so
it's really worth emphasizing how much Mordor sucks.
Yeah.
Like, does Sauron like living there?
Right.
Yeah. And so you end up with this, I think, folk idea of what Tolkien's stories are about, wherein there is this very simplistic morality. But then when you go back and like really revisit what Tolkien was writing, he was fully aware of the sort of fickleness and foolishness of humanity. And there, that is all over those books with pretty much everyone except the orcs. But also just the, you can just read what Tolkien, the sort of the history that Tolkien like lays out for himself, where, you know, wherever these things came from, where these people came from, they have been under the thumb of one dark lord or another for a really long period of time. And even when they're not, it's not like, you know, sometimes the orcs are our friends and sometimes they're our enemies. They do seem to get like killed on sight, generally. The wars between the dwarves and the orcs are pretty openly genocidal in the way that Tolkien describes them. There's never a sense that there's ever been any real rapprochement. It's just, you know, you see an orc, you kill an orc. And by Tolkien not solving that problem by making it really clear that they're always evil, you're left with this, oh, are the great and the good peoples of Middle-earth, you know, the people that we're sort of accustomed to thinking of as in this sort of like folk idea of Tolkien as being, you know, as wise as the elves, as brave as the dwarves, are these people also, while they are all of those things, so flawed in that they are sometimes genocidaires? And if they are, what does that say about Tolkien's legendarium? I don't think that's a counter reading of Tolkien. I think that's a straight ahead reading of what Tolkien does. And I think it really enriches his work to let that flaw just sit there rather than try and explain it away or try and find a reason why actually it's okay to kill orcs generally, because I think that's something that many followers of Tolkien or sort of people influenced by Tolkien just took and didn't interrogate. But they didn't interrogate it. Let me, how to put this?
But can I ask you something, Oscar? So what's the original sin? I mean, he's part of the Catholic contingent at Oxford, right? Is the original sin just original sin? That, like, you know, Jesus won't come for 5,000 more years to Middle Earth?
I mean, I think the original sin is the devil. It's very like demiurgic, right? It's like the devil wants to get involved in creation and, you know, sticks his oar in and allows the existence of evil into the world. Or even just the existence of the capacity for evil. You know, theoretically, the elves are supposed to be created and live their entire lives in heaven in a state of grace. And then Morgoth, you know, does all the things that Morgoth does. And suddenly there's war and there is the capacity for individual greatness, but also individual, the sort of creation of individual suffering. They are very Christian books in a way that I think we all kind of know, but like when you go back in with that lens, you can really see it.
It's not as obvious in Lord of the Rings as it is the C.S. Lewis books.
Yes.
When we talk about it's okay to kill an orc, we actually have in the movies have to deal with this at some level, whether explicitly or implicitly. And one way that they do it is they make Uruk-hai. Another way is through Legolas and Gimli keeping kill tally, which many soldiers do in different combats throughout, you know, human history.
David, there's an even better example. Think about how the Fellowship of the Ring ends. So it ends with Legolas, Aragorn, and Gimli believing that Frodo is dead and the ring is in Saruman's hands. Or at least they have no reason not to believe that, because Frodo's gone and the ring is gone. They find, I think, Boromir's body.
Right.
They find Boromir dying. And what do? Right. The war is lost. They're like, well, fuck it. Might as well go hunt some Uruk-hai for sport.
Right.
And I mean, there's more to it than that. They have Pippin. Like, there's no reason for them to assume that Pippin and Merry are alive, or that, frankly, that there's any, like, Pippin in the hands of the enemy is actually a huge asset to you, given his, given how good he is at fucking stuff up.
But
I mean, it ends with their like, well, nothing to do now, but I guess, like, you know, go kill some orcs before the end comes.
And then that flows back out into our modern culture. And then we see living enactments of that, some of those ideas in Dungeons and Dragons and other role-playing games, where we have a races or, you know, of organisms that we can freely kill so that we can be heroic, so that we get to be the heroes of the story.
And an interesting counter reading in the Blizzard Warcraft games, where the orcs are men Orc is man to orc.
Right. And it's interesting to watch new games. I haven't checked out Daggerheart, but MCDM's new game, Draw Steel, they don't have bioessential races. They have, here's a race, and they're complex, and they have a tribe, and they have motivations, and they have individuals, and you can play them. And there is no sort of race that's sort of excluded necessarily.
Yeah. I think what's really interesting about orcs is that as long, basically since Tolkien created them, people have been trying to figure out their take on them and sort of like carrying out these sort of essentially like literary arguments of like, okay, well, this is the orc, we're reacting to Tolkien's orcs, or we're reacting to the reaction to Tolkien's orcs. And what is so interesting is that even many of the attempts to redeem Tolkien's orcs still position them as being in conversation with tropes about savages or sort of ideas about primitive peoples. It's like, maybe, you know, maybe the orc is not evil, but he is, you know, he's like, he lives in a tent, right? Like he's probably maybe like a nomadic pastoralist at best. You know, there's not a sense of like, oh yeah, you know, like the orcs, great merchants in the cities, you know.
An industrial proletariat, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. That's text.
Yeah. So you end up where even the sort of attempts to fix it, take it in what I don't think are inherently bad directions, but certainly some eyebrow-raising directions. I think even Blizzard's orcs, again, you know, the orcs are tribal, or they're Mongols, or they're always, even when they're good, or at least they could be our friends, they're always othered. There's not really a sense of them as being sort of among the free peoples. And I don't, you know, I'm not someone who believes strongly that there's like any particular way that you shouldn't tell a story if you can get away with it, or you can do it in a sort of interesting and sort of considered way. But I do think there's been a lot of, not a great deal of consideration for how people have been like, well, they're bad savages, but what if they were good savages?
are you saying that no matter what, orc is orc to man?
I am saying that, yes. I will say, I think Dungeons & Dragons has finally, after much kicking and screaming,
yes,
sort of like been pulled around to actually like, everybody's just a dude and everybody can just sort of come from anywhere. And if you want to play an orc who runs a coffee shop, go with God. And like that, I think, is actually a really nice change. And
it took them a while, and
it took them a long
lot of pressure
time.
And a lot of conversation, and we have a rise of other games that are starting to check, I don't want to say challenge dominance, but we're going back to an early 80s state where there's just a garden of games that you can, a role player wants to go out and play, you can find all kinds of variations and cool things. I'm curious though, from your article, what kind of feedback did you guys receive?
Did we get feedback?
Not very much. I mean, people seem to like it on social media. I didn't get anyone yelling at me about it.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's a nice thing. I'm glad, because we get yelled at for mispronouncing Galadriel.
Well, the key thing is because it's not an audio medium, no one needs to know how I pronounce any of the words in there.
Bravo. And I think that, too, your process here, we'll get into some heat death process later on, but this is a really great blending of literary criticism, anthropology, and history sort of all together. This seems like a sweet spot for kinds of articles that you guys like to approach.
You know, David, this is a great opportunity for us to ask you, what is heat death?
I don't know, because, I mean, there's a website, there are articles, there are indications or signals that there might be a larger community. I have not interacted with many other heat death readers or fans. I was quite shocked to see that somebody who I've interacted with in the podcast space is going to be writing an article for you guys. We know Tansy is going to be writing something, it sounds like. So then as I'm engaging in the writing and I'm trying to learn who is an author of a particular article, because you guys don't always indicate who's the author. You do this interesting thing, and these are some of my notes from the behind-the-scenes things. You do these really interesting things where you're breaking the fourth wall of literary stuff, and you're, this is heat death, stay with us. Like, I love that sort of This American Life sort of hook. And I'm like, I'm fascinated by that. And then, yeah, anthropology, environmental, history, modern culture, like I said at the top of the episode, I feel this intellectual and spiritual kinship with whatever is going on at Heat Death, what I'm not really sure from one aspect to another. All I know is I'm reading your headlines of your articles and I'm going, oh, damn, I got another thing I got to read, another thing I got to read, another thing I got to read. And then when I go through one of your articles, I don't know where I'm going to end up or why. Why am I reading about the Azerbaijan and who is the people in the conflict there? That
Armenia.
Oh, yeah. The Azeris and the Armenians. The prefiguration of the Russian-Ukraine war.
Oh, that's true.
And how does that relate to Star Wars? I'm like, wait a minute. What's going on here? But I'm loving the journeys that I'm on and the intellectual landscape that I'm walking through. So that's not a explicit description of what I think Heat Death is. It's my experience of Heat Death to date.
Yeah, so I would say that Heat Death is a stock pot on the stove at about a 4 or a 5, right at the point when something is starting to caramelize.
Yeah, that is a much more poetic description than mine, which is, what are the Elbine brothers interested in this week?
I think there are, I asked you the question and we're both sort of sitting here like chuckling a little bit because we've been really wrestling with like,
sure,
what is the elevator pitch version of Heat Death?
Yeah.
And we've done things like, it's the nature of culture and the culture of nature, or like, Oscar and I read a brewery the other day and I was like, maybe it's everything is evolution or evolution is everything. And I think what I can say historically, and I think that's maybe a better way to answer the question, because that's what our approach is. Our approach is, what are the roots of the thing that we're talking about? And the roots of this thing were, we were both getting the feeling of like sort of tiredness and enervation as we interacted with media. Mm-hmm. And I think the best example of the media that produced that feeling was Disney properties, and particularly Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
Really, it was just like, just this vast wasteland of not quite art, mm-hmm, really.
Right.
You know, like art flavored product.
Right.
And at some point we just realized that was a really interesting and generative thread to pull at. What is that, that really felt like it was not just the experience of like, you know, watching an Avengers movie, but also really kind of tied into the experience of being alive in this era. And of course we're both working journalists too.
Right.
There was a similar feeling in covering politics. I don't know. I've been thinking a lot, actually. Another sort of very, very Heat Death-y property is The Rise of Skywalker, the last of the... There's that moment in there. Is it Oscar Isaac?
Yeah.
Where he's like, he's sort of like the...
Can I? Oscar Isaac, looking like a man who knows the check is clearing, but the money hasn't arrived yet, says, somehow Palpatine has returned, and he looks dead inside as he says it. It is a remarkable moment because he's probably acting. He's a very good actor, but he sure doesn't look like he's acting. He looks like he's worried his career is dying as he says it.
But also, somehow Palpatine came back.
He did.
So I'm going to put a pin in this part, and I'm going to put a label on this pin called the inshittification of pop culture, and we're going to pick it up at the bottom of the episode, because this is a great segue into starting to talk about your series Decline and Fall, Star Wars as an Imperial Chronicle.
Everything is Star Wars, yeah. Evolution is everything, but everything is also Star Wars.
Everything in America, anyway.
Everything is everything. That's Heat Death.
That's Heat Death.
Put it in the pot, baby. See if it cooks. Stone soup.
In this conversation, first I want to throw it to either one of you to describe the project overall, but I also want to put this little caveat that there is this level of the project that I'm observing, which is both fictional analysis and political allegory. So our conversation can bifurcate at any point along the route here, and we're going to be twisting in and back around itself. So with that, Asher, you got a...
Also, Asher, he's missing a couple threads.
Yeah.
Because I'm trying to read all the articles and understand the flow, and I'm dipping in and out. So I absolutely don't have all the threads. So set it up for us.
Why don't you mention the threads? I was going to talk about how the project came to be.
Yeah, that's good. And David, I'm not. So basically, we conceived of it as being sort of like 3 to 4 main strands.
Awesome. Okay.
All of which kind of get tied off in the mid 2010s with the Disney purchase of Star Wars.
Right.
So one thread is an in-universe historical allegory,
right?
Which is, the tale of the decline and fall of the Galactic Empire. The story opens in episode one with this Baroque but very functional empire running into trouble. It ends in a period of complete anarchy in the galaxy. Everything's fallen apart. That's one narrative.
Right.
The frame story around that is George Lucas's attempt to create this epic, which he sees self-consciously as an allegory for an American decline or collapse of democracy.
At the same time that he's consuming all kinds of different media and other pop culture and trying to process through.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Which also feeds into this, but that's sort of like sort of more minor tributaries.
Right.
And the final thing is the actually existing history of the American empire as it enters the neoliberal period, as the New Deal coalition cracks up and something new emerges. And actually there's a fourth thread, which is the corporate history of Star Wars, mm-hmm. which is how Lucas's vision becomes part of this imperial Disney project.
Right. The story of the IP, of the intellectual property, itself is shaping the story of what stories are being told to us. So we can't discount it from when we look at Ahsoka or we look at, Mandalorian and Baby Grogu movie coming out and all these things. We cannot discount that. Or the way that the Acolyte was treated.
Mm-hmm.
And we both grew up on the Expanded Universe books,
okay.
which were, especially now, you can read them very much as, and to say for listeners who don't know, these were the books that came out in the 90s. Oscar may want to say more about this.
Yeah, a lot of our listeners will be very familiar with.
Yeah, so for those who aren't elder millennials, they're books about what happened after the Death Star was blown up at the end of Return of the Jedi. Of course, there are no more Star Wars movies, so that's all we've got. There will never be anything else. Let's write some books. And what happens afterwards, of course, is liberal democracy, guys. The end of history. I mean, obviously, if you take away the tyrant, I know, it's more complicated than that. There's like, you know, there's you know, it's a world of disorder. And in a lot of ways, it ends up being these remappings of the 90s conflicts, like the Balkan Wars, especially, mm-hmm. onto the Star Wars universe. But overall, like, peace returns to the galaxy and a flawed but practicable liberal democracy, somewhat United States, somewhat United Nations, returns. When Disney buys Star Wars, that shit all gets somewhere between retconned and shit canned. And in many ways, a much more interesting, as well as much more depleted universe. But that's the Star Wars that we grew up with. And that Star Wars is explicitly a political allegory, a political product.
And when we move as a whole industry of television, TV is doing something different. I don't want to say that. But from movies, at least, we're not coming from creator vision. Hey, I got this really cool story that I want to tell. Will you give me some money to make it? We're going from the studio going, hey, we own some shit. You, go make this movie where a bunch of people fight and make sure that we get it out by this date so that we can hit, you know, these milestones and metrics. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're driving profit over creative storytelling.
That's a really good point.
But Asher, I'm curious just to know more from your side on the...
Well, so two things. There's one sort of addendum to Shoal's point I want to make, which is that the very end of the 90s expanded universe, which of course, as the sort of, you know, lasted into the aughts, there's a very interesting thing that happens, which is that Star Wars, because Star Wars can't end and Star Wars has to keep having Star Wars in it, as we get into the aughts, there is a sort of, in fiction, in universe, complete crack up of the kind of 90s martial New Republic that is sort of like bringing liberal democracy to the rest of the galaxy and like detente to the sort of imperial remnant. You know, there's just a sort of dizzying turnover of different governments and, you know, characters getting killed. Because again, the story has to go on. You end up in a very sort of permanent state of crisis, a la like the Marvel or DC universes, where every summer a city has gotten flattened or, you know, the president has turned into a chimpanzee or whatever. So I think one of the things that's really interesting about Star Wars is to look at it both on its own terms, but also as a serial narrative, and thus under the sort of constraints of serial narrative, in addition to everything else, because the constraints of serial narrative are also the constraints on our imagination of what a story can be. There is a world where Star Wars stories moved away from the New Republic out into like the frontier of the unknown regions, and that didn't happen because people wanted to keep reading about Han, Luke, and Leia, and that meant Han, Luke, and Leia had to keep having adventures, which meant that the project that they spent their entire lives fighting for had to fail.
Oh, right.
Which is what ends up, of course, happening in a way that didn't upset anybody and that people were totally normal about in the sequel movies. So to take a step back and look at where Decline and Fall kind of came from was that it sort of arose out of conversations that we were having.
And there's about a dozen articles, right?
About a half dozen full articles, I think.
Yeah.
Approximately 1,000 with another several hundred new members. Yeah. What it felt like subjectively. They're meaty.
Yeah, there's a lot. So we initially were just talking a lot about the fact that, you know, the period from the prequels to the end of the sequels does not cover a vast amount of time. It's about 70 or 80 years. And if you look at the sort of equivalent chunk in various areas of what I guess we could call Earth history, you know, the 70 to 80 year period from before World War I to the mid 60s or 70s covers a truly incredible amount of stuff happening. The same is true of the period around what you might call the sort of the exciting renaissance of the Italian wars and the discovery of the New World and the sort of extractive crack up of the sort of buildup of all these extraction industries that are pumping, you know, more and more resources into Europe and fueling bigger and bigger wars that are sort of rippling out in all these ways. And so we were just sort of talking about like what would happen if you tried to read Star Wars as history, which is something that various people have tried to do, I think, generally always interestingly and productively. It's one of the few fictional universes, I think, that can really sustain that level of scrutiny if you try. And
which was Wyman's point. Patrick Wyman of Tides of History was like
America's largest historian. Yes,
yeah, that's right. Yeah, big friend of the show.
Yeah,
yes. Right.
Yeah, we were talking a lot about this, and I think we initially, it took a couple of different shapes. We sort of toyed around with the idea of it as a podcast. We pitched it a little bit as a sort of a big sort of like united feature and wrote a treatment for that. And when we were kind of both a little bit at loose ends during the pandemic and trying to figure out what we were going to be doing with our copious spare time, we were like, well, maybe this is the Heat Death project. And it sort of evolved into, I think, a much more sprawling and kind of idiosyncratic version under our pens, because we could just sort of follow areas that we were interested in a way that if this is the 10,000 word version of this entire saga is very different than, I don't even want to think about how many thousands of words we're on now, but more all the time, hopefully.
Well, I'm counting 12 exactly articles under the Decline and Fall hashtag on your website.
Some of those are free previews.
Okay.
Free views, if you will.
Like three of them, though.
Yeah.
I mean, I think probably the 10,000 word version is the piece Asha wrote called The Long Star War.
Right. And I've read a couple of them that seem to be a historian writing what happened in a movie, not explaining the movie per se, mm-hmm. but hey, I'm a historian and I'm sitting back at my point of view. And now I'm going to recount these events and what led from one thing to the next. But then we go to Decline and Fall Annex, Kosher Torture, and we get into the Andor of it all. That takes a very different turn. And so it seems like there's a mixture of treatments here.
Well, let me say, I don't know if this answers your question, but to us, I think,
don't know that it was a question.
Well, so I think the most fully realized of the Decline and Fall story treats a specific movement in the film franchise, weaves together in-universe history, out-of-universe history, that's shading into the in-universe history and corporate and IP history. Right. And they don't all do that. Like the Andor piece you're talking about doesn't do that. It's explicitly a treatment of the idea of how an empire could evolve out of the Republic without anybody quite noticing.
Right. And I was really picking up on some of the notes of violence and the use of violence, which was then also making me think back to some of the orc-related stuff. With orcs habituated to violence, is there, what's in the note here I've got? Orcish, the idea of self-fulfilling prophecy, could orcish violence be reactive and not innate? And when we're looking at a empire that's breaking up and the need to use violence as the only way to get the yoke of the empire off of you, now you're Luthen and you're condemned to use the tools of your enemy to effectuate that.
David, walk it back further than that. The Republic is cracking up.
Right.
The Republic doesn't have a standing army. It's going to fall apart. What we're going to have is civil war, true civil war, for the first time in living memory. The Jedi are completely ineffectual. Mm-hmm. Like, what do you do?
Right.
And then how does your answer to that question, you know, after you have successfully held the order together through a succession of civil wars, what does that look like 20 years later?
Right.
And because certainly this thing we talk about a lot, like, you know, the Imperial leadership that gets blown up on the Death Star, many of those are old Republic guys.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they would have kept doing their jobs under the Republic.
Quite possibly.
They're institutionalists in a way.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the fact that one of the, I think the smartest things that George Lucas did in the prequel trilogy is he kept the iconography of the Republic as what became the Imperial iconography. Right. He could have done a coup. There could have been a start break. It could have been Palpatine seizes power, and now all the iconography is different. And he's invented this thing called the Star Destroyer, and it's got this like very like angry shape. Like he could have done like that. That would have been in many ways been an obvious choice to make, and he didn't do that. And that was an incredibly powerful thematic choice, because what it says is forms can stay the same as everything changes.
I think that's a really important point too, because when we see clone trooper armor merge mm-hmm. into stormtrooper armor, when we see the Venator class ships turn into Star Destroyers, that the visual iconography, I'm an elder Gen Xer, so I saw A New Hope in the theater.
Oh, wow.
And when we walk out of there, we're like, oh, those are Nazis. Yeah, it's okay to blow them up, right? Because they're wearing, you know, those kinds of uniforms. Mm-hmm. And I grew up on a steady diet of World War II, America, G.I. Joe, Saturday matinee television shows. And so, you know, that's the diet that I was fed all along. And so this idea of American imperialism, and that it's okay to use violence in these particular times because we're on the right side of the story.
Uruk-hai, also clone troopers.
Yeah, that's
very
true.
Good point.
Do we know if the stormtroopers by the time of A New Hope are conscripts? I mean, I'd assume they are because that's cheap.
Yeah, that's been pretty well established at this point in the sort of like ancillary materials.
Conscripts or volunteer army?
Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah. I think it's...
Luke is just waiting to go volunteer, right? Like, and he doesn't see anything weird about that. He's not like, I am going to go work for the evil fascists. But you know what? Either like, I'm down for it, or, you know, it's what you got to do if you want to fall. He's like, no, man, I'm just going to work. I'm going to go join the army. I'm going to go work for the government.
Which is a very relatable story, where at least for our American military, where do a lot of our volunteers come from?
Luke is from to all appearances, he's from northeastern Nebraska.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I want to pivot really quick. I don't know that I've seen any articles post Andor, so I'd love to get your guys' hot takes on the series as a whole.
Fucking rules.
Yeah, it was great.
And specifically, any things that you're holding on to that are any ideas or perspectives that are exciting you?
I sort of joked to Shaul, after watching the first couple episodes of the first season, that it is like decline and fall of the TV show.
Mm-hmm. Well, we can only assume that they've been reading us.
Right. Tony is a regular reader. Did he subscribe? Is he a Patreon?
He's got to be. He's got to be. It's under an assumed email for sure, but he's got to be.
Of course.
I think that what really spoke to certainly me, and I think Shaul as well, is that, you know, Star Wars is fun when it's silly. I'm not someone who's like, oh, Star Wars, you know. There are a lot of people who get very annoyed when Star Wars is ever silly or ridiculous. Part of the appeal of Star Wars is that what if Nixon was an evil space wizard that had, you know, chimpanzee eyes in one movie until we thought better of that. But the thing that I really liked about Andor is it takes the sort of material reality of the universe in which it takes place very seriously. Mm-hmm. And that makes it a very historically informed, like very clearly very historically informed and very interested in the ways that sort of historical revolutions happen. And that makes it an incredibly rich text to read in the sort of material way that we like to approach this. One of the things about Heat Death is that we don't ignore the Force, but we are not, I think, super interested in the sort of mythic aspect of Star Wars storytelling. That is very well-trod ground.
We are annoyed by the Jedi.
Shaul is annoyed by the Jedi. I would say I like a lightsaber fight as much as the next guy, but I think that there's
like lightsabers.
there's been so much quasi Joseph Campbell mythical cod storytelling that has come out of Star Wars, and it's not that I don't think you can do interesting stuff with it. It's just that mostly people don't, and there's not really very much to say about it that I think it interests us.
Right.
And so what my feeling about Andor was that I would not have been upset to see the Force occur, like be more present in Andor, but that's mostly just because I trust that Tony Gilroy would have come up with something interesting to do with it. And every other sort of aspect of the sort of like early formation of the rebellion, the way that he engaged with it, was so interested in the nuances and complexities and personality conflicts that it's a delight. I don't think we're ever going to get anything like it again.
There's an interesting thought too with Star Wars. There is the Clone Wars aspect of it all and mm-hmm. Skeleton Crew aspect of it all the way through. And behind it, there's this really strange mysticism as to with mm-hmm. the mother and the daughter and these sort of ley lines, these cosmic ley lines and space whales. It's very, would it be dangerous to say Kabbalistic in nature?
Possibly, but again,
because there's a mystery behind the mystery.
Well, but what's interesting about that is that is, in a sense, it's apocryphal, right? It's not mm-hmm. apocryphal because, you know, Filoni, for there are people who like his work, and God love him, but Filoni has the keys to the car now. And so that stuff is pretty well baked in. But it's hard to know how much of that is part of Lucas's original sense of what Star Wars mysticism is, which really seems to be sort of making, you know, making no assumptions about Lucas's own spiritual life, sort of California burnout Buddhism a little bit.
Yeah, it is certainly Goetia. We can certainly say that, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's not even Jewish Buddhism.
Right.
But I think that because I know a little bit, I've watched a little bit of various parts of Filoni's sort of Star Wars properties. And I know it's expanded into there's time travel and ley lines and sort of embodiments of the Force. And that is not, I don't want to get into it. Well, it's not my Star Wars, but it's not my Star Wars. It's not mm-hmm. the way that I'm sort of accustomed to thinking about Star Wars. And it has never added anything for me. I'm not saying that it shouldn't be there. It's just, it doesn't speak to me. And so I think the way that we've been, you know, we've taken a little bit of a hands-off approach to a lot of the Filoni material in Heat Death. I like the Clone Wars fine, and I like Rebels a decent amount, but it just doesn't feel like it's something that has felt like it's in line with the kind of story that we're trying to tell. And so mm-hmm. we've sort of batted at it a little bit, and we'll probably bat at it a little bit more as time goes on, but we're sort of not. There's a couple of really good Star Wars books that are very much in line with recording the sort of Disney continuity. And we're not exactly not doing the Disney continuity, but we're not exactly doing the Disney continuity either. Like, we're not going to spend a lot of time talking about Rebels.
Right.
We're mostly focusing on the films and Andor because we really like Andor and it's our newsletter and we can do that if we want to.
Here's a hot take. I mean, it's not really a hot take because this is the way that we've been thinking about it.
And, well, is anything ever a hot take on Heat Death?
We do not. They're all hot takes. It is called Heat Death. they're not hot takes because the universe is now very cold.
So, getting cooler all the time.
Sit with this, but locally, sometimes it gets hotter. So I was talking about the destruction of the expanded universe when Disney took over the property. And I think, having grown up with this idea that the way the Star Wars story and the trilogy inevitably ends is with, you know, peace and democracy of some court, however often interrupted, Disney presents a real downer. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, it just all falls apart. They take over the Empire and then nothing. But I remember when I was watching The Force Awakens, as much as it's like a confused mess of a movie, and as much as the political situation specifically is confused, there was something that felt really right about the idea that, like, Leia Organa actually is completely incapable of running a functional polity. There's actually something that feels much truer in the idea that after, you know, the ragtag rebels seize the capital, they're not able to put the shit back together. That's actually usually what happens, right? It's not generally the case that there's the big pivotal battle and then suddenly, like, the insurgents take over and everything goes great and they're able to put their guns down and it's generally respected and they follow the rule of law. Like, none of these people have lived in a world of rule of law. The only order they've ever known has been the Empire's order, which is rule by force, and specifically an order created to terrify. So what I think I really liked about Andor this time is that it really puts its finger in a much smarter way than J.J. Abrams is able to do on that dichotomy. Mm-hmm. It says, what kinds of people are attracted to the rebellion? What kind of circumstances are evolutionary favorable to rebellion? And what kind of empire provokes the rebellion? And one thing that I think it really nicely, I don't know if it's like hanging a lampshade exactly, but, you know, there's this very, very capable imperial bureaucracy that's kind of like all jockeying for position. There's these sort of like tragic comic moments that sort of recall to me, like Hannah Arendt's Eichmann in Jerusalem, mm-hmm. where Eichmann is just this, like, he's just like an office style dipshit. he's got the big Holocaust project, and he wants everybody to understand how hard he was working on it and how he was sabotaged by all of his, there's some, a lot of elements of that that come into Andor, where it's like, you've got these people who are at the absolute top of the game who are working for this evil space wizard. Mm-hmm. Like, why are they building a Death Star? It doesn't make any sense for them to be building a Death Star, except as an entire theory of power built on nobody's ever going to like what you have to do, or just a sort of pathological worship of the ability to blow things up. And I think all of that in less capable hands could have been a real mess. I think in Andor, it ends up kind of this sort of soulful meditation on power and violence.
Also, very funny, screamer of a, it's not even exactly a running joke, but just the structure of the sort of ultimate downfall of the ultimate big gun weapon being Imperial, stupid Imperial office politics in a way that somehow manages to wipe out the entire upper echelon of the security service and the entire basically Joint Chiefs of Staff in like the space of a week.
Right.
Hilarious.
Right.
It's so fucking funny.
Right. Yeah. 10 days. Yeah.
And it's all because Deidre Miro just wanted, what did she even want? She wanted the promotion? Like, she wanted the recognition? Like, what did she want?
She wanted to be involved.
She wanted to be involved. Yeah.
I was working on an idea about accelerationism and, you know, Luthen as an accelerationist.
Mm-hmm. Mm, absolutely.
And is Deidre Miro also, she's not an accelerationist, but she uses accelerationist tactics to achieve certain ends. And so I was starting to think about that's an interesting look at these two characters who are in this cat and mouse game for the entire two seasons.
So Oscar's theory, Deidre only does 5 years in Narkeena 5 because sort of a rebel Operation Paperclip springs her and realizes that she can be put to any uses as long as you give her a lot of credit.
Right.
I was also going to say, I think Deidre and Luthen share a operational policy, which is when in doubt, pull the fire alarm and see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Chaos is a ladder.
The verbal duel between them in like the second to last episode or third to last episode is incredible.
Yeah. My last question on the Star Wars topic, and then we can begin to wrap it up a little bit. Is Ferrix a Marxist anarchy as Bakunin would have envisioned it? I've just been listening to the Revolutions podcast all about the Soviet Revolution. And
Tony Gilroy, noted fan of Revolutions.
And he was on the Daily Show with Jon Stewart recently with Mike Duncan, I was like, oh, I need to go listen to his...
Wait, Gilroy was with Duncan on the Daily Show?
Yeah, well, the Jon Stewart's podcast.
Oh my God.
Which let me recommend for those of you who don't know, Mike Duncan has the most recent season of his Revolutions podcast is a fictional telling of the revolution on Mars.
Yeah.
Incredible work of science fiction. I was completely rapt listening to it, waiting for every episode to drop. Goes really well as a companion piece to Andor, actually.
Okay, great. I had just learned about his podcast. And so given that Gilroy is noted that a lot of his vibes come from the stories around the Russian Revolution and that era. I thought, that's a good place to just jump mm-hmm. in. And it's a really nice listen, 30 minutes or so, and he's really good at just delivering the stuff. And so I was learning all this history that I had vaguely intellectually aware of, and I was like, oh, wow, that's really interesting. So I'm really fascinated, too, with this idea of Ferrix, which is this kind of anarchy, right? This sort of each to his own and to their need kind of thing. Yeah, there's a weird corporate control, you know, out there, but we're here doing our things and we look after ourselves. And yeah, we've got our own internal squabbles and people are being people.
What I think is really interesting about Ferrix, and this doesn't really answer your question, but it maybe points in another direction, which is that what's really interesting about Ferrix is that, I mean, how long has the Empire been the dominant force when the movie opens? Like 15 years? I mean, Ferrix is still basically independent. There's these sort of like strange islands of corporate independence. And I think one of the things that we get from Andor that's really interesting is the idea of Imperial control is like very heterogeneous. Mm-hmm. The Empire isn't everywhere. In fact, the Empire isn't most places. Like maybe part of the reason why Luke wants to go join the Empire is like, who the fuck knows what the Empire is, really? Like, there's a recruiting station, you know, down by the cantina. You go when you turn 18, And who really knows what happens after that?
It's so big that you can't actually see the shape of it.
Yeah.
Where we can, because we have this omniscient point of view.
But it's thin. It's thin, too.
Yeah, so thin.
Like, this is
which Andor shows.
Yeah, which Andor, I think, makes a lot of hay out of. You know, the scene on the, I forget the name of the planet, where the sort of Ferrix crew is hiding out at the beginning of season two, but...
Oh, Space Iowa.
Yeah, Space Iowa. The thing that kicks that into motion is that, oh my God, an Imperial inspection is coming through for the first time in 3 or 4 years?
Longer, even, I think.
That's really interesting. That says something about how the Empire is not nearly as integrated into... I mean, that's a little bit like imagining that, you know, you're in Space Iowa and you have no interaction with any federal entity whatsoever for 15 years. That's crazy. That's a crazy thought.
But yet the threat of violence looms that if you don't produce, then the boot's going to come down.
But this is where the Death Star starts to become interesting because, well, you could try to build a mass-based political order.
Yeah, with all kinds of political officers and
cadres, sure, public work.
Yeah.
This is the
civilian corps in uniform sort of just,
Yeah, you got it.
Scouts.
Sports. Sure. I mean, they don't, you know, it's a big galaxy. You know, we have a very thin textual record, even with all that we have, given the size of the galaxy. So who's to say that all that's not happening? But we do know what the number one priority is of the Empire, and it is the Death Star. Gun. Not even garrisons on every planet, right? Which would require, again, that mass recruitment or conscription apparatus. One gun that travels around the galaxy, be a big threat.
Yeah, that's a clear strategic choice that they're making, which is we can't be everywhere all the time. So we just need to have this floating gun that we can go put in Buddy's face at any given time.
I mean, there's a sort of, watching Lord of the Rings this time, there are some definite overlaps between Lord of the Rings and Star Wars. I mean, there's sort of like, Palpatine is like the ghost of Morgoth, right? That keeps coming back. I wonder if there isn't something sort of similarly religious about it, in that the kind of state that Palpatine wants to build is such an outgrowth of who he is as a person, and such an outgrowth of the nature of evil. It's not that the Empire couldn't do that thing. Like, I think we all, growing up watching this media, had assumed that they had. Like, we assumed that there were garrisons everywhere, right? Like, I think all of us assumed that it was like sort of like Nazi Germany. The state was everywhere.
Well, you roll into Mos Eisley and there's troopers on patrol.
Yeah.
But there are troopers on patrol because...
Yeah, but the troopers are in patrol because they're looking for... They're looking for the MacGuffin. Mm-hmm. Like, they're looking for the Ring of Power, right? Like, they're not generally there. It's very weird that they're there. Or it seems very weird that they're there.
Well, I think it's weird that they're doing checkpoints because they do have a spy, right? There's a spy who reports in on the Millennium Falcon, right? So they have a bit of an infrastructure.
Right, there is an intelligence.
But maybe
network.
It's a very light hand, and they don't show unless they need
to. So this is the other thing about Andor. We know that they work with corporations,
contractors.
They work with organized crime. I mean, I think it's less Bakunin anarchism than like anarcho-capitalism, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh,
like,
right.
They're,
yeah,
they're
good
like point. They're happy to work with the Hutts.
Right.
They're happy to work.
Well, we can't get our forces out into that area, but the Hutts already have a degree of control, so let's just co-opt them a little bit.
Yeah. I think it's much more paramilitary, much more parapolice, much more
it's a gangsterism.
State. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And we'll use whatever we need to, wherever we need to maintain our upper echelon apparatus.
It's a gangster state with elements of an impersonal law and order. I mean, you know what it actually is so, you know, in Latin America, they use the phrase mano dura, like strong hand or iron hand, which is for a very, it's like what Rodrigo Duterte did in the Philippines.
Right.
So sort of Trump has some elements of this approach. It's things have gotten so bad that we need a strong guy.
Slap down. Where is the Setka, or is that?
Cicot. Yeah. El Salvador and Guatemala are sort of ground zero for this kind of, this specific, at least branding of that kind of politics.
Which is an interesting, I think opens up a whole other conversation, which is why is that reaction at a almost species level? We see time and time again, and is it a reaction to conditions. I mean, we could say right now, there's a lot of weird stuff going on in the earth, especially around our climate, and having surety of leadership, does that answer something, some sort of uneasy feeling in our collective psyches?
Strong pitch to be able to make.
Maybe. But you know, you can flip it and say that the sort of the concept of the mandate of heaven in in a lot of Chinese history is often, especially with the sort of propagandizing around this Ming uprising against the Yuan Mongol dynasty, was, oh, we've had a lot of floods and we've had a lot of famines and nature is not working right and dragons have been seen in the rivers, and that means that ruling dynasty's got to go. It's time.
Right. Or Nile, hey, I am the intermediary so that the agriculture can continue because we have water on a cyclical
basis. But floods and famines also, like, there are no natural disasters, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mismanagement.
Especially in a highly organized state. For the grain to get from, you know, grain planet, you know, to where people are eating it requires a lot of order. And if that starts to break down, then you have a famine.
So yeah, I think that there is, you know, certainly the rise of breakdown or perceived breakdown provides a lot of potential accelerant for this kind of very personalist leadership of, you know, I alone can fix this.
Yeah.
And I think there have been times in history where you do end up with pretty capable administrators that come in on a wave of reform, and sometimes that's political reform, and sometimes that's reform at the point of a sword. But, you know, a lot of time what you actually get is somebody coming in saying, you know, now that I'm in charge, everything's going to be different. And what really changes is where the spoils go is into their pockets instead of whoever was the guy beforehand.
Which gets into this whole thing about human nature and scarcity. We respond to scarcity. Toys on the playground, scarcity. Grain in the universe, scarcity.
I will say one thing that maybe is another for assembling a list of potential heat death taglines, you know, for the future elevator pitches. There is no human nature.
Mm. Yeah.
Does that land for you, Osher?
I like it.
It's a big galaxy.
I think to sort of like peel that out a little bit. The idea of human nature is really an argument about what we think humans do. And the answer to what humans do is everything.
Mm. Like, everything that's within our sphere of physical control, the things we can build and the things that we can envision. We can't teleport. We don't have telekinesis.
Yeah.
No, there's no,
well, I mean, speak for yourself,
right,
here, but
right.
Yeah, I think that there is a tendency in historiography and generally like thinking about the past to say, well, like human nature is what we do, and they must have done that in the past too. And there's certainly, you know, there is...
We're all human.
Right. We're all human, but that also means that there is a tremendous diversity of behavior and cultural approaches. And I don't mean that in a way of everybody is different, but rather in a way of expanding what we think of as human nature away from the idea that there is a one set way that people react to things, which I think if, you know, when you really engage with history, you start seeing that there's all kinds of different, along with all the commonalities, there's a ton of differences that are culturally mediated or environmentally mediated, or just, you know, just down to whoever was in the chair on the day and their own particular weird dysfunctions or functions.
They were just like us, weird little bastards.
Yeah.
I can't remember where I pulled this quote up and out of your platform, but archaeology of worn out narratives.
Mm-hmm.
That's good. I think that was Osher.
That might have been me, yeah.
That sort of set my mind running to this question of enshittification, and we'd put a pin in it earlier and now sort of coming back to it. I kind of feel like at times what we're trying to do on the Lore House, maybe not explicitly, but more just trying to feed our own minds and souls, is to find these, you know, these deeper meanings and to examine the sphere of our own consciousness and the fractal nature of our own consciousness through narrative stories, primarily television, followed by movies, followed by books and music. And right now it just feels like the enshittification is overtaking us. And I feel like, you know, we're swimming in this. There was a really interesting podcast I listened to the other day on the Vox Media on Today Explained, and they had a podcast. The topic was, "This is your brain off books." And we're starting to look at the TikTokification of thought processes and knowledge. Obviously, we have AI and what's that's doing for people. They had an interesting conversation about, was that another podcast? It's all blurring. Anyway, but that we're in this time where what is the value of information and what is the value of thinking about information? Information, fact, and fiction are now equal, right? The truth and lie don't have any differentiation when you have AI that can generate visual images and movies and write whole PhD theses in a blink of an eye versus, hey, I really worked on this article, whether I used AI or not to help me write the article, but it's like my ideas, I struggled with it, I wrestled with it, I crafted it. I had a podcast, I had an interview, or we watched a show, we took our time, we actually broke down the episode, we had our human reactions to it and thought about it, and these are the things that we're thinking about it, versus the inshittification of Star Wars. Disney bought it for $4 billion? Four fucking billion dollars? Like, that's a ridiculous sum. And what are they doing with it, right? It's becoming inshittified.
I'm sure they don't know what they're doing with it.
Right.
They clearly don't seem to know what they're doing with it.
I mean, that classic, like the question of, it was an auteur thing. George Lucas knew what he was doing. We might not have liked it or agreed with it, but he at least, there was a person, you know, a person
right.
with an embodied life experience and things that kept them up at night.
And he co-opted some other people to help him.
Yeah, sure. You know, yeah, he chose, you know, like everyone else, he chose what to be influenced by and what not to be influenced by. He, you know, had a particular hobby horses. He had a weird love of made up names that were like you know, scrambled Dickensian, like whatever. Like, you know, he was
lucky
a dude,
with an editor that he was married to.
You know? There you go. Yeah. Dudes are dudes to dudes, right? You know, he's like, Star Wars what grew out of a human brain, and then it made the jump into this thing that was fundamentally un or even anti-human, which was, you know, a corporate controlled
intellectual
IP machine.
Property.
Which, by the way, Disney also, you know, grew out of an auteur. You know, I don't much like Disney. I don't much like what he, like, you know, his vision, but he had one. He was a person with a vision with his own prejudices. And I would argue that as we've left the anti-Semitism and racial pathologies of Walt Disney, too, we have left, you know, the interesting humanism of George Lucas. But
also some racial pathologies there, if we're being
fair. Oh, sure. Yes. Good.
Very, very, very fair.
Good point, yeah. Yeah. If we're, that's a good point. But the thing that I would say that I like, where I draw hope from, and I think where we've drawn hope from, because like we see the same thing, right? Like, that's why we started writing.
And which is one of my questions about Heat Death. Why Heat Death? Like, what is it that these two brothers, that how do you both ended up as journalists?
Because entropy is everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because entropy is everywhere. You can't get away from it.
Right.
The one rule of the universe, and it sucks, but this is the rule, is that ordered systems decay.
Mm-hmm.
And we specifically as a species are an incredibly effective means of transitioning order into disorder is what we do. Mm. Like, we eat order and we shit out disorder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we eat order and we excrete disorder through literal heat or through our actions. Our civilization turns order into disorder. There's no other way to live. That is the particular fate of life. So within that context, then I think we look at,
isn't Heat Death as a project then counter to that? Are you?
I think it's paradoxical, but yeah. I mean, I think to us, we saw the landscape and we said, look at all of these things that they have left for us to play with to make something beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Look at all of the terrain that has been seeded. And I think we thought, you know, to us, the big question is, how did things get here and where do we go next?
Mm-hmm.
And the question of how did things get here is a historical and artistic one. And in the case of Star Wars, the question of how Lucas's empire became Disney's empire and what that tells us about our current age, that's, I think, an exciting and generative product.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that is made more exciting by the fact that most Star Wars isn't like Andor.
Yeah.
Oscar, does that land for you? Like,
no,
I'm kind of spitballing here.
It does. I think that the way that I think about this when I'm sort of sitting down to write something or sort of editing someone's work or even like sort of reviewing the pitches that I've been getting recently is, this, what is the approach to storytelling or thinking or this topic that I haven't seen before, that I have not heard over and over and over? Because part of the genesis of Heat Death for me was actually Game of Thrones, which was the particular waking up after too long of a nap, bad mouth feel of just endlessly regurgitated. Hey, did you know that the last season was bad? How do I know that the last season was bad? Well, everybody on YouTube is saying the exact same three things, which is not making an argument of the last season of Game of Thrones as secret genius. I think it's fine. But there was an exhaustion of just hearing the same thing over and over and over, just regurgitated over and over and over, which was, let me hear someone sit down and say something new about this. Let me hear someone sit down and figure out a different approach, like come in through the side door, like something, anything different, because I will die if I am at another party and another person comes in and like Star Wars YouTubes at me for like 15 minutes. You know, I want to hear what individual people think. I am not interested in hearing constant reheated and rehashed cultural narratives around this stuff.
And I think that's what we try to strive for on the Lorehounds. And we're also in that balance game of being critical without being negative.
I mean, you can be negative, but be negative in a way that you've put some thought into and not something you just heard somebody say.
Critique or criticism.
Yeah.
Right.
I love a pan.
Sure. We have to be very careful on the podcast because we're also entertainment.
Yeah.
And when we have strayed into negative criticism, you know, negatively sounding criticism, we get feedback. Enragement equals engagement. We don't get emails for nothing. We put out all these great podcasts and then we say something wrong or we go off on a little bit of a tangent. Maybe we
talk a little shit. Yeah.
Yeah. And wow, you know, hey, you just spoiled my experience of this thing. With The Last of Us for this last season, both John and I loved season one. John's played all the games. He is, you know, a big fan of it. And we just had to say on the microphone, look, we're going to talk bad. And if you don't like that, please do yourself a favor and do us a favor and just don't listen to this podcast. There's no reason to do that right now if you think you're going to have a counter point of view on it. And that seemed to work. And people were like, oh, thank you for your freshness. Thank you for your approach on this. But it is very easy to stray into these things because we are entertainment, but we're trying to be entertainment that is nutritious. We're trying to offer a point of view or a thought about something that's human, that's us. I took time and I took this episode, this 45, 50 minutes of television, and I spent 3 to 4 hours preparing for this podcast.
I'm cooking you a meal.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
I think I like a little bit of fast food now and then. I'm not putting on airs and graces here. When we, I think, sit down to do something for Heat Death, in the same way that we do for our professional writing, I think we're very much wanting to create something that we put some thought into, that we put some of ourselves into. And if that means that we're talking shit, then you're going to get, hopefully, some well-considered shit talk that is prepared as carefully and with as much thought as anything else, and is not just there to be a cheap Big Mac for you.
Right.
So I think, yeah. So maybe here's how I tied it up is I'd say, if you know what doesn't nourish your soul, like if you know it feels like a bad meal, then you can sort of work from that to get, you know, that's the shadow of maybe what a good meal would be. Mm-hmm. If you know what leaves you feeling empty and that sort of like margariny slick on the back of your metaphorical palate.
Right.
What's the opposite of that?
You eat a pint of ice cream and the next morning you feel hungover and depressed for the next week because you've just flooded your gut with sugar.
Yeah, sure. If you're lucky, it's the next morning, right? With the kind of meat that we're talking about, right?
But the idea is that be present to yourself.
Yes. And also there's a sort of a tantric like flip that you can do where you say, everybody is having the same experience of watching this shit and not feeling nourished.
Right.
We are suddenly all in community again.
Right.
Right.
So what do we do with that? Right. Like how do we pick up the bones and build something with them?
So that pivots me into some questions about Heat Death and Heat Death's community. Like you're taking pitches, you're bringing in some other authors, it seems like at this point. I was curious, a technical question, if you guys like Ghost as a platform. So
We do.
We like it a lot.
It's good.
Versus Substack, because we've been sort of struggling, like, do we do Substack? Do we do Medium? Do we do Ghost?
I don't remember why we decided to do Ghost instead of Substack. I think I was a little uncomfortable with Substack, a decision which I have to say has only proved, I feel like I called that one right around the time they started sending out push notifications from Nazis. So
their interface is good. Like their interface is good is the one thing. It's like, you know, if you want a Twitter replacement, that's like a main page of the internet, theirs isn't bad. I will say it's very, very, very AI heavy.
In shitification. Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I actually want to interact with newsletters in that way.
Right.
But I've got friends who use it as sort of a replacement for what Twitter used to be and seem happy with it. And we've, by the decisions we've made, we've locked ourselves out of that interface.
And it seems like Ghost has the nice balance point between being a blogger style site and a newsletter Substack site. Like there's enough of a technological overlap between those two ends of, I don't want to call it a spectrum, but at least those two areas that Ghost, and Ghost lets you own your own stuff. You know, you have some choices about where things are hosted and how things are hosted.
Yeah, it's a very good sort of like meat and potatoes hosting. It does everything you need it to do. Maybe it doesn't have the bells and whistles, but honestly, that just means that we focus on the actual thing that we're making and not, you know, stuff that doesn't really matter.
Unfortunately, we don't get to share hosting with Matt Iglesias, which has been a real blow.
I know. Every day I cry that, you know, we are not basking in that particular radiance.
It's a real halo that we're missing out on.
I have thoughts, but I'm just going to hold on to that guy. Yeah, it was interesting to watch his trajectory, too. It's sort of...
Speaking of a very heat death ass trajectory.
Right, exactly. Ezra Klein almost went there, too, but he seemed to have pulled himself back a little bit.
When he
talked to... who is the pollster, the gambler guy?
Oh, my God. Yeah. Silver.
Yeah. Oh, that was... Oh, I'm just putting this down for a while. And he seems to be back on a better wicket now. But anyway, in terms of... upcoming topics and who you guys are working with. It sounds like you're trying to pull in some more authors. Is that new or has that always been part of the project?
It's new.
Core's idea?
It's new. We've done a little bit of it before,
okay.
But it's new. It's an explicit attempt to try and find like-minded voices and connect with broader communities.
Right.
And in a sense, it's like, you know, you talk about fiction being a mirror. I think by seeing how people relate to the project and what they pitch us, we discover what the project is.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. And do you have any themes or ideas that you can share now with what's coming up? Or do you want to play that close a little bit?
It's not a matter of playing it close so much as that I have a bunch of pitches that, due to sort of family stuff within the brothers Albine, it's...
We're launching a new product.
We are...
That is a baby.
Mazel tov.
Thank you. Well...
Yeah. Well, fingers. Preemptive mazel tov.
Besotiv, certainly.
So that just meant that I have a bunch of pitches in my inbox that I've been looking through and sort of doing preliminary screening of before I send them to Shaul.
And what do you do when you're working with presumptive authors?
Usually, you know, I'm asking... It's very weird, I have to say, to be on this side of the editor desk where, you know, I'm like, oh, have you written anywhere before? Like, you know, what is the shape that you would like this essay to be? And it's the thing that's a little tricky about it is that sometimes I'll get pitches. I've gotten a couple of pitches, some of which I haven't even forwarded to Shaul, that are just like, they're really good pitches, but they're not heat death.
Right.
Where I have to be like, oh, you should, have you thought about taking it to this publication or that?
Without, you know, talking out of turn, what makes them not heat death pitches?
Yeah, there was someone who wanted to do a reported piece about a convention of political impersonators.
Not heat death?
Not heat death.
Could be heat death, not obviously heat death.
Yeah, it would be, I would have a little bit of trouble explaining what might make it heat death. I think we could have workshopped it to get it there, but it was a good enough pitch that I was like, you should take this somewhere else. Also, the other thing is, we have right now a somewhat small paying subscriber base, which is enough to pay for some, you know, pay out some amount of money as a sort of like small honorarium for people who write for us.
That caught my eye in one of your last newsletters, and I went and I subscribed because of that.
Oh, thank you.
Great. Well, that's what that money goes to, that and hosting. We don't take any money off of it, at least at this point.
Exactly. And I recognize that because we have a lot of co-hosts who are not full-time podcasters, but they cover certain topics with us. We make sure that we honor the creative relationship with them, and we pay out flat fees on, you know, whatever the mechanics of it are for podcasting versus a written piece. But we make sure that the creative relationship is appreciated and not extractive, I guess we could say.
Yeah.
What we essentially offer people is a little bit of money for your time, but it won't cover your time.
No.
Like, if you're writing for us, you're a good writer.
But I acknowledge you spent time on this, and therefore I see the value of what you're giving.
Yes.
And what we're giving you is you're going to come out away with something that you're going to be legitimately proud of.
Right.
And
as a clip.
And we don't take any rights except for the right to run the piece first on heat death. Right. You're going to come away with a piece that you can then, you know, you own it completely. If you want to further develop it somewhere else, if you want to do anything with it, it's yours. It would be frankly criminal to like try and grab any rights for the amount of money, which is like $50 to $70 that we can pay.
Right?
So we're basically renting it off you for the like world debut, this version of its world debut. And then you can take and do with it whatever you please.
Well, I think that's a interesting place to wrap up. I have so many open notes on the outline that I created for this. And I think this has just been a fascinating and fun conversation. One of the things I was like, I stole this from Ezra Klein. What three things? He does that on books. I like to just open it up to anything, movies, TV, articles, music. What are three things that are each of you that has your attention captivated right now? Something that's giving you nutrition or giving you Big Mac feels?
I just finished a biography of Marion C. Cooper, the creator or sort of like primary co-creator of King Kong, which is called Living Dangerously,
okay.
Which is a really engaging and enjoyable biography, but also did make me realize that I think I have a King Kong novel in me, which is a terrible thing for an author who's got a bunch of book projects already to realize.
I'm going to shamelessly plug a friend podcast of ours, Every Single Sci-Fi Film Ever. Aisha Ooh. Khan is running the history of sci-fi on screen, and King Kong was on early in her run. What she usually does is bring in two academics and then...
Oh, that sounds great. Yeah, hot take about King Kong, that shit still rules. There are some classics you return to and you're like, I can see why this was influential for the time, but that sucker moves. So what else? Other two, saw and really liked Superman. I thought that Superman felt like a sort of enjoyably personal and like kind of like idiosyncratic superhero film, which is not always something that you can depend on.
Mm-hmm.
And a very interesting film to watch from the perspective of a diaspora American Jew.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think my third one is that in terms of like sort of Big Mac quality, Netflix's K-pop Demon Hunters is a incredibly made sloppy burger that you will eat and be thinking about for the whole rest of the week, even though you know you shouldn't eat more of it anytime soon or you'll feel sick to your stomach. But in terms of perfect trash, I cannot recommend it highly enough.
As a dad to a 9.5-year-old, I can tell you.
Oh, I'll bet.
It's taking the youth by storm.
On repeat in your household, I'm sure. It's on repeat in my household with my partner who is a K-pop girlie. Right.
Yeah, my wife too is... So my Big Mac recently, my wife's gotten very into The Rookie,
mm-hmm.
a truly trash yes. Nathan Fillion vehicle. What I like about The Rookie is what it's taught me is that I think part of the reasons that there's been this sort of like pop culture conservative turn against the cities is if they're watching shit like this, no wonder they think cities are dangerous. Like these guys, like in the A, B, and C plot, there's like four murders per episode. It's like one precinct in Los Angeles and people are just being murdered like flies.
Right.
Is that the Nathan Fillion show?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I like that dude.
He sells it. I mean, it's pretty good bad. It's still bad though. I don't know. It's like an homage to cop show.
Seven seasons, 126 episodes. That is.
It's not, you know, it's like Justified for Idiots. I just finished John Ganz's When the Clock Broke, which felt like a really wonderful work of historical archaeology. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make these points too explicitly because it doesn't have to, but it's a deep reading of the election season of 1992, which ends up being this kind of masterful historical prefiguring of our current moment. And I think really, he really, I think, explains and explores the role of the uncanny and the mythos and the unconscious in American politics. In a way that I think is very rare. And I've just started reading Rulers, Raiders, and Traitors, which mm-hmm. Patrick Wyman just interviewed the writer of, which is an epic history of the horse, being sort of the key explainer of Eurasian history.
Interesting.
Which I'm only a little bit of ways into it, but I'm really enjoying it.
That book is excellent.
Where can folks find you besides your website, which is, I believe, heatdeath.io? I'll put a link in the show notes.
Yeah, it's heatdeath/ghost-ghost.io. You can find mostly, I write for The Hill, where I'm a staff writer, and you can find me there or on Blue Sky.
Mm-hmm.
And you can find me at numerous publications, but mostly these days, the New York Times, Nat Geo, and Scientific American. You can also find me at Blue Sky, at Osher Elbein, or at my website, osherelbein.com, which has a sort of updating list of features but gotcha. It has not been recently updated, so awesome. I need to do that.
Also, if you like what we've been putting down here, you should buy Osher's Book of Short Stories.
Yes. My
Ghost Days.
Ghost Days, which is a book of short stories about an Appalachian witch at the turn of the century encountering various sort of spooks, haints, and the sort of downstream effects of extraction in Appalachia.
Has anybody optioned it yet? That sounds interesting.
Boy, I sure, you know, from your lips to God's ears.
Listen, Tony, we know you're listening.
Iger. Iger's a regular listener.
I'm taking offers if anybody would like to. That's all I'll say about
that. We'll entertain Iger's offer, all right? But he's probably not the guy.
Probably not, but, you know, he's got connections. I just want to encourage everyone to go check out Heat Death and subscribe. I've thoroughly enjoyed this conversation, and I hope we can find some space to do some more conversations in the not too distant future.
When we get to the New Republic period, let's talk again.
Absolutely. Well, maybe a little sooner than that. We're not moving super fast here.
Fair enough. All right, Saul and Asher Elbein from Heat Death, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
The Lorehounds podcast is produced and published by The Lorehounds. You can send questions and feedback and voicemails at thelorehounds.com/contact. Get early and ad-free access to all Lorehounds podcasts at patreon.com/thelorehounds. Any opinions stated are ours personally and do not reflect the opinion of or belong to any employers or other entities. Thanks for listening.
Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Dutch Boy's DuraFighter is an interior paint and primer in one with a tough-lasting formula. It provides great scrub resistance and durability with remarkable hide and a smooth finish. Save big on Dutch Boy's DuraFighter paint at Menards and start your next project today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at Menards.
Your kids could get free or low-cost health coverage from Medicaid or CHIP. Even if you've applied before, they may be eligible now. Kids up to age 19 are covered for checkups, vaccines, dentist visits, hospital care, and more. And if they already have Medicaid or CHIP, remember to renew every year. Visit insurekidsnow.gov or call 877-KIDS-NOW. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.